It is Saturday, August 29th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Brian Young, a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Hey, Brian. Bonnie. How you doing?
Good to see you. And Lyle Troxell, a software engineer, face painter, and family man.
Got to pull that face painter out of that tag. Hi.
Do you? What would you like to put there instead?
A maker. Probably.
A maker.
Yeah. Or plumber.
Okay. And plumber?
No, you don't want to put plumber in there. No? You forget all of that.
All right.
No? Lyle Troxell, software engineer, maker, and family man.
Ooh,
hey,
good.
Lyle.
I like that. That's good. Thanks. Hi, Bonnie.
Yeah. All right. Should we start with a little PSA? You've got some information that may be useful to people, Lyle.
Yeah. Warning. Check your phone bills and make sure you're not being overcharged, especially if you've had a phone company for a long time. And I'm not actually talking about mobile. I'm talking about your landline. Remember that? And you canceled it? Well, maybe you didn't. So this story comes from Ars Technica actually covered this story. And from Glen Ridge, New Jersey, Lori Haller took a look at her bill and was like, wait, what's this $24 or $25.95? Oh, my gosh. That's for a phone line I canceled in 2000. Yeah. So she pays the bill that she's owed, due, minus 24 or 25, 90, whatever it is, right? And then calls up customer service, and they say, oh, so sorry. And they give her back the 3 months past, not the 10 years or 14
15 years?
Yeah. Did she have proof that she canceled it?
Well, there is a bit in back and forth on whether that happened or not. But the truth is that she kept on trying to get that. They wanted her to pay that extra $25 a month, and she couldn't get that to stop. And so finally she actually contacted NJ.com, which I'm assuming is something in New Jersey. And they called this press company, called Verizon, the PR company, and finally came down to Verizon. Oh, my gosh, sorry. And they're paying her $1,500 back. So clearly, they're claiming in the wrong.
It took professional hassling by a PR company?
This is what it takes in the age of all customer service reps know how to go through the scripts on their computer, and they don't really get any authority to do what they want. Yeah. They just have to go through the scripts. So in any case, she was saying that this is April 2015 is when she noticed this, and that's how long it's been that she wasn't being reimbursed. She's now being reimbursed. The company spokesperson says most likely she never canceled it. But
of course she says that.
I don't believe that.
You know, I had a run-in like that with a gym that I had canceled the membership a long time ago. And they went, yep, we're totally going to cancel that. And then I didn't check my bill for a while. And then I checked my bill and I went, oh, they didn't cancel it.
I feel like one of the ways to deal with that when you're using credit cards as the payment system is have a credit card that you don't use ever point of sale. It's only for these repeating service charges things. Mm-hmm. And that way, it's a relatively clean bill when you look at it and review it, and you're pretty sure that, oh, wait, I don't have that gym membership anymore.
So what you just described is reviewing a bill, which is would have worked if I had had a separate credit card for it or not. I just need to check my bills.
And the thing is, with those phone bills, there's a lot of charges on there.
Yeah.
Well, and there's the taxes and all these other random things, and some of them fluctuate every month.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
It's funny. For years, I've been laughing at everybody still paying for AOL, and now we're talking about actually just paying for a landline is getting lost.
Her second family landline in 2000 before they had mobiles probably.
Maybe she used it for fax. Oh, there's another one.
Oh gosh. All right. Well, in things that should be open source, frankly, like access to phones or the ability to get rid of them. I'm kind of surprised to hear, Brian, that Pixar has done some big, generous, open source offering to whoever wants it.
So I thought this would be fun to talk about because in geek circles, there's nothing more or nothing less controversial than talking about Pixar because everyone loves the movies Pixar is coming out with. Mm-hmm. Well, the major studio is open sourcing yet another project which they've been working on and is fundamental to their tools in the house in the studio.
What is it?
So
this
one's got a mouthful. It's called the Universal Scene Description Language, or actually Universal Scene Description. So in computer graphics, there are many, many technologies, and this one is the technology used to describe what is in a scene, what the camera can see, what is in view.
So the light, the virtual lights, the set pieces, of course, the characters, probably their movement action, or really we're talking about just the scene, the
backdrop
kind of virtual representation of a space.
The literature I saw was not clear whether they're including the animation controls in there. I don't believe that's true.
Now, not everyone knows this, but Brian, you actually used to work for Pixar. In fact, you were one of the lighting designers for Monsters, Inc., for
Monsters,
example.
Monsters, Inc., and
which
I'm assuming
you were using either this or the predecessor to this when describing the Monsters, Inc., like, door scene with all the doors.
Exactly. So when... when I was there, they were using all sorts of tools. They always have these proprietary tools, and I saw a very early version of this that as it evolved over the 10 or 15 years ago since I was last there. What I thought was interesting is here is Pixar open sourcing another tool. They also have something called Open Subdiv, which is a way to describe geometry, which they have also open sourced several years ago. And they're open sourcing more and more of their tool set. And of course, they sell RenderMan to major studios and students.
Right.
Don't they also
have Hydra, which is the GPU renderer?
Those are the
is
bad
that
guys.
An open source
what
project as well? Or is that...
I'm not familiar with the term Hydra, but okay. I believe that is not for sale or open source. I think that is their internal lighting system and rendering system.
Okay.
Yes, it's a GPU-based rendering system, so they can get very fast feedback as they're working on the images.
Huh. So what could a person do with this if they had it?
It's actually bigger than this. I'm going to read this line to you. The USD, which is the universal, what is it again?
Universal Scene Distribution
will include embeddable direct 3D visualization provided by Pixar's modern GPU renderer, Hydra, as well as plugins for several key VFX DCCs. Comprehensive documentation, tutorials, and complete Python bindings.
Yeah, that makes sense to you?
No.
But it made sense to you, right?
Yeah. So what they're saying there is that this tool, the scene description tool, is going to be out there, and people are going to be able to incorporate it into their software. So you can't go and buy the full tool set that Pixar uses and make a movie with it. But you can go out and buy Maya, or even use the free student version to learn how to use Maya, and there are other tools out there as well. I'm going to croak on what they are.
But, that's okay.
What's happening, though, is those tools that you can buy, even the open source one like Blender, they're made for one artist to work on one project.
All right.
And the big leap between having the off-the-shelf software and what a studio does that has always been there is how do you collaborate with hundreds of artists?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you work together so that everybody can work in one space?
Right.
Now, software development has solved this years ago.
I wouldn't say solve it. We made it easier with source
management.
Well,
has worked on this problem for a long time.
Sure.
And in fact, the internal tools of Pixar actually use and share some of the software development tools that people who write apps use. But I just thought it was really interesting that they're open sourcing more and more of their tool set.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the entire pipeline of tools that they use to generate the movies that we love to watch is the renderer. And that's what they have sold for years and
RenderMan.
Years. RenderMan is their renderer.
And it's been used, name, I have to say.
It's been used for eons. Mm-hmm. Jurassic Park by ILM's effects group used that
It's an industry standard only, even though it's a proprietary system. Yeah.
But by getting more standardized tools out there for artists to use, then they're going to be able to collaborate between studios and
create
schools.
Kind of an ecosystem. That's one of the reasons why we love open source, is the ecosystem aspect of it.
Yes, Bonnie.
So if a person was interested in this, what would they be doing with it? Collaborating with other people to make their own movies? If it's not the animation aspect also, are they using it as a still environment? What's happening? What could happen with it?
Well, what could happen with it is the tools that professionals have been using for years to collaborate are going to start slowly coming out to where more people can use them.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm really excited about is students being able to collaborate on big projects. And now this project is not going to be released until 2016. So we're talking a little prematurely here. But
mm-hmm.
Once it gets out where software vendors can start including it in their own software, like Maya has included the Open Subdiv project,
I see.
We get more standardized tools. We get better collaboration, and we will be able to enjoy the fruits of better artwork. Because computer graphics is incredibly complex, and it's taken a very long time for these kind of tools to be standardized.
Uh-huh.
And so here we go. One of the major leaders in the field is making that a lot easier.
I like that you sum up with this will allow people to make more art. That's cool.
Well, and that's what it's all about, because these are tools. They're nothing more than geek tools, but if we can get them in the hands of more people, you get better art.
Mm-hmm. So they're not just available to end users, but to other companies who make products that are available to end users.
Yeah. And there's a democratizing force going on here. Mm-hmm. Now that's what open source software is about.
Yeah.
And this is furthering that. The thing I thought was extra interesting is here the major studio Pixar is deciding that their tools are more valuable out in the public, out available to more people than it is for them to hoard them and control the use of them within their own studio.
Reminds me of Tesla.
It does. Tesla does the same with their engines, that's right. Mm-hmm. Or their battery power as well.
Okay, well that's kind of amazing. From here, what we look for is just to see where it pops up and what's possible on the more indie scale.
Yeah, let's hope that the indie filmmakers out there get a chance to start using this. But like I said, it has to get into the full ecosystem first.
Right. Okay, so that's the open source update. Now let's have the latest drone news.
Ah, good drone.
Yeah.
Let's mix drones with stupid criminals. Actually, I don't think these criminals were that bad.
Yeah, this sounds pretty good, actually.
Wait. By definition, criminals are pretty stupid because they get caught, right?
Not all criminals get caught.
There's all circumstances.
Criminals we know about get caught.
Yeah.
Faudis Shorts and Keith Bryan Russell, were recently arrested. They were searched because they were close to a federal prison in Maryland, and in their vehicle they had a lot of marijuana, and actually synthetic marijuana, also known as spice. I've never heard of this.
Oh yeah, it's apparently it's nothing like marijuana.
They also had a lot of CDs of pornography, a whole bunch of tobacco in bags, a phone, and a loaded handgun. That's also not very good.
Mm.
And other materials, but multiple packages of small sizes of this. They also had a quadcopter. Now, a quadcopter, of course, is a flying vehicle that's relatively stable. They can carry a payload. They were near a prison.
Payload of small baggies of goodies, perhaps?
Basically, they had planned and are being charged with smuggling into the prison all these things that they had. Now, the fine is about $1,300 per item, actually, so it could be pretty bad for these guys.
Every item is in a separate bag.
Basically, it would be very hard to stop this kind of thing. The police luckily ran into them. So they were basically going to take a drone, pick up some tobacco bag and put it in the drone, fly it into one of the prison yards, drop it, and fly back and keep doing that for marijuana and pot, marijuana and tobacco and a whole bunch of stuff.
For all their goodies.
Right,
and
this is the currency within
the prison system. I think what was wonderful about this was that the police officer says, you couldn't imagine this, some kind of statement of that nature. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, no, of course you can imagine that. It's like the first thing you think of when you think of a quadcopter is that you can fly things anywhere you want. And one of the places you don't want to take things is there. Also, smuggling over the border. Of course, that's something people will do with these things, right? Obviously. There's also kind of a number probably made up that it would cost about $400,000 to protect a prison from this kind of drop-off. And the drone only costs like $1,000. So you'll probably see a lot more of this. This isn't the first time that this has happened, but this is the first time that it was caught prior to the drop. At one federal prison, the stuff was dropped in the yard, and it was taken by a lot of people, and a riot ensued, resulting in 205 inmates being strip searched. So
how do you fly this thing over the wall and not get seen?
I do wonder about that a bit. How do they know when it's safe to fly it over?
Maybe they didn't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how loud, what kind of weather conditions. It also depends on
how high.
Can the guards hear the environment? Are you listening most of the time? Because most of the time, you have a whole bunch of posts and you have people there and they make sure no one crosses the road, the fences. But then again, the fences are high and there's alarm systems for motion detectors. I mean, a large facility like that is going to have quiet spots, and all you have to do is kind of look for it. Additionally, the people that are flying the vehicle, the worst case scenario is they lose the drugs in the vehicle. normally, unless their car gets found. You definitely want to be farther away.
Yeah.
But the point is, it's not a lot of risk for the people outside, right?
So if this is an enterprise you're considering, be sure to keep your car a little further away from the prison. Stake it out well so that you know when to make your drops. And also maybe coordinate in such a way that a riot does not ensue.
Yeah, okay.
And let's review. Keep it below 400 feet or else the FAA will get involved.
We are not actually recommending any sort of
enterprise. No, don't do this, of course.
Okay. I tell you what, we're going to talk about other things when we come back, including we'll touch in with the Energy Department,
See
how things are going in geekery over there.
Too. Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, we'll be right back. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Brian Young and Lyle Troxell. You can visit our website, by the way, geekspeak.org, to learn more about what we're talking about, catch up on what you missed, perhaps, if you're just tuning in, and see things that we call web extras. These are visual bits of geeky delight. And Brian, when did you first feel geeky delight?
Oh, geeky delight. You know, it's funny. I look back, and of course, I loved Legos. But when I look back at my childhood, what really got me into it was model trains. I got so excited by model trains. I took over the ping pong table in the living room, and I got out you mix up the foam to make up your mountains, and I got into the, wiring up each of the switches so that I could control
from scratch.
It was great. I spent a good number of summers into that, and the reason why I'm talking about this is because I just got reminded about my love of model trains when I saw this recent video. I want to direct you to our website at geekspeak.org. Somebody built a model train with an infinite track. One long spiral,
okay,
and then a bridge from the center of the spiral out to the outer edge. And you can watch this thing and get nicely mesmerized looking at a train continuing.
The other thing is the train is about the same length as the track.
It has to be.
And it's connected together.
It covers the entire track.
Yeah, it looks like it's kind of a mind. I will admit that I saw this web extra when we were talking about putting up on geekspeak.org. And I had to look at it for a minute or two before I could really grok what I was looking at. It was pretty amazing.
It was cool.
Yeah.
Stare into my eyes,
yes,
Bonnie.
Yeah.
So
I told you about my mother.
Why did trains help you be a geek? I don't understand the connection. I mean, trains and geeks kind of go together to some degree.
Well, you know, it's sort of the maker culture. It's sort of the getting lost into a really geeky project.
Oh, getting really focused on something.
Really focused on something. Yeah, yeah. And going into areas you'd never gone before. I didn't know anything about chemistry and mixing up foam and then all the molds that were involved, the paints that were involved, the electronics that were involved until I got into trains. And it was just because I felt this control over my environment by building this artificial environment, this model.
Do you have a train now, a model train?
It's in some boxes that my kids are desperately asking me to set up, and I need to find
a place
to build
it. Are you one of those guys in your retirement you're going to make an A model? Is A the size you can sit on?
What's the
size you can sit on?
That'd be awesome.
All around the property?
No, I think, I think
XXL.
My antidote was moving close to Roaring Camp where we can ride our own trains.
Oh, there you go.
Full size ones.
A railroad here in the Santa Cruz area. All right. Well, you know, that's interesting you talk about that because I feel like I'm starting to geek out now on a project that has to do with an old typewriter case that I recently acquired, was given to me, and bits of it are not working. It's a bit damaged.
Wait, is it a case or a
it's
typewriter?
The case. Well, I got the typewriter too, but I took the typewriter, got it cleaned professionally. Okay. Oh, that cost something.
I bet.
And then I looked at the case and it's a mess and it stinks. So I got to get this fabric off of it, so I tore it up, you know, and then all of the different little hinges and
there's little compartments,
the metal hardware and stuff that attaches so that you can like lock the typewriter in there. I'm like,
talking about like the cover that totally disconnects. And
yeah,
comes
so I'm trying to figure out, like, I've never worked with rivets or metal or wood before, but I'm like, I want to make this typewriter case good again, and I'm learning about rivets and how to de-rivet.
You know, rivets are actually they're great. When you have rivets and a rivet gun and like really know how to do it, it's a great way to seal something. It's cool.
I'm totally excited. I feel like I've entered into a new realm of analog geekery.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah,
what are you going to cover the what are you going to use for fabric? Like a faux
I don't know.
Leather?
I mean, part of the fun of this is researching. Like, I want to talk to the woodworker I know about working with wood. I want to talk to jewelers I know about how to deal with the tiny metal parts.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to the bookbinders I know about how to cover fabric on wood and not have it be all warpy.
Yeah.
I don't know. In the in our culture and in our friends, our geek friends, there really is this attitude that you can do almost anything. Just talking about rivets, I have a friend up in Oregon who he's a pilot, but he hasn't been able to fly in years because of the direction his life turned. But he's decided one of the ways he's going to get back into it, he's going to build his own plane. And he's gone to classes on how to rivet the metal together and build an actual flying plane.
Awesome. I hope that he tests it well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there's all those FFA.
Bonnie, one of the things the maker movement is doing is kind of feeding off itself, of course, by doing YouTube videos. And I recommend, if you like boxes, to take a look at Adam Savage's boxes.
Adam Savage's
of
boxes.
Of the Mythbusters and other
things.
Yeah,
fame. Yeah, I know
that guy. He loves making custom boxes for things. Now, you already have a box, but one of the things he will regularly do is make a box, and then he will glue on a faux leather, and he shows how to do that and talks about it. And then, like, put more metal corners and stuff on to protect it. But basically, watching someone do it definitely is a good learning experience.
I have to say that's part of what made it seem so approachable to me is a jeweler friend said, here is a video about rivets. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
It's all on the internet. And that's delightful. Like, I feel like now I can really sink into that kind of analog level project. But it's a little frustrating when I try to think of myself as a geek because I can't even work my latest update of iTunes.
How so?
Well, they keep changing it. They keep updating it and like, okay, how am I supposed to navigate through here now?
Meaning not even like you're updating it. It's just updating.
It's updating on me.
Are you talking about from your phone or your laptop or both?
Both. Yeah, you know, like having it interact somehow. Well, it's kind of, you know, even that's a little bit muddy to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, while I had just gotten used to the most recent update.
The former most recent update. Yes.
The previously recent update of iTunes and kind of figured out how to navigate around a little bit, but I didn't do a full investigation because, frankly, my interests lie in the analog world. Now, here's another one.
So, Bonnie, do you even know what time scale you're talking about between these updates? Can you think back?
It feels like a couple of months. It feels like every couple of months there's another update.
And would you say you use iTunes every day or you're...
Well, no.
Yeah. So
no, I don't.
Yeah. So the interval at which you're actually using iTunes and getting a chance to learn it is too slow for the amount that they're updating it.
Right. So here is my beef, gentlemen. At which pace should these developments go? At the pace of the excited developers or at the pace of the end users?
Okay, well, first, let's talk about the actual timeline we're talking about. You're relatively new to Apple.
Yeah.
So you started using iTunes relatively recently because you switched to Apple.
No, I had iTunes on my Windows-based phone.
On your Windows-based. But it would still be very different between the two.
Excuse me, on my Windows-based computer.
So currently, iTunes 12 is the current version. And this year, there's been five updates.
Right. So it's updated five times since I've owned my first iPhone.
Right. But a lot of those are actually later in this year when they released the new Apple Music, which fundamentally changed the way the whole interface was.
Right, and I've not been able to figure it out since.
So the question is, if you're happy with learning one and finally using it, and then it updates, who's that update for?
Right.
Yeah. I think in this situation, it's mostly for Apple making more revenue off their iMusic service.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
They're satisfying themselves and growing their own ecosystem. I mean, my joke about that is... it's job security for UI departments.
Uh-huh. Are you pointing your finger at me? Is that what you're doing?
I may be pointing my finger a little bit at just generally not the people who are hired to do UI.
Necessarily.
But the UI strategy of any particular
company. User interface design is all about, presumably, what my job is making the experience better for the individual user.
Mm-hmm.
And the way large companies do that, like Netflix, for example, is where I work, is we actually do it in a test form. We try out something by rolling it out to thousands of people and then look at different groups of people that have different, slightly different user experiences and see which ones of those use the product more and stay with the service longer.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, we assume that that's the better experience and therefore we roll that out to everybody.
Yeah,
and so we do that regularly. I don't think Apple does test-driven development like that. I don't think they do that.
Yeah, I'd be surprised about that as well because, well, first of all, you can't just divide your software up into tests so easily.
But you can't. They could roll it out pretty easily to different environments if they wanted to. They're not. I mean, it's very clearly versionized, and they're clearly showing the packages the same. That's interesting to me because Apple does something very different than Facebook or Netflix or Google or list a lot of other companies.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these companies, what the companies are doing is trying to make everybody happy by looking at what people are doing and provide that backs
that. Adjusting
yeah.
accordingly.
Apple has, and they base all that off of algorithms. They base mm-hmm. off of the general policy is, let's make the algorithm smarter. These are the things that actually try to interpret what your want is.
Yeah.
Search engine algorithms is a good idea. Your friend feed is an algorithm. And all of these are honed to allow you to use the service more.
Mm-hmm.
Watch more Netflix,
mm-hmm.
Use more, you know, find the search engine results faster,
mm-hmm.
Make more posts and read more stuff on
Easier
Facebook.
Easier use means more use.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's all the algorithms. And that methodology does not put the human individual's designer in the forefront. It puts the algorithms and therefore the software engineering behemoth behind it
mm-hmm.
in the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been extremely successful. That's why Google exists. That's one of the reasons why Netflix mm-hmm. exists so well. All these, we do a good job of this. Apple does something very different, though. Apple has fewer people in general in the design area,
mm-hmm.
and they make decisions, and they drop stuff, and they roll it out. And whether they do a lot of customer feedback and studies, I don't know if they do. I'm sure they do some. Mostly it's driven by intelligent, egotistical people that think this is the best way to do that.
Well, and once we have bought their devices, we mm-hmm. are at their mercy.
Yes, but then again, you bought that device because it's awesome. And they do a really good job. I mean, that's the other thing about this. I think Apple does an amazing job with software interfaces and devices. Hardware is beautiful. It's functional. And I don't have to think a lot about it. At the same time, when they switched iMovie, or specifically when they were working on, what's their video, the Pro video?
Final Cut.
When they moved Final Cut from one version to another version, it was so frustrating to the entire industry.
Right.
I don't even know what resolved that. I think the people moved to Premiere.
A lot of them did.
But it sounds like they didn't learn a lesson from that.
Well, it depends
what their
goal
was. They're still the most successful company
on
the planet, so they're obviously doing fine.
Well, it's because of this, though. It's because of the hardware that they've already sold us. And now it's just a matter of rolling out the software.
Well, they would argue it's because of the mindset of how they build the products.
Yeah, I think it's the whole package. I mean, there's a reason why a lot of people buy the product.
Yeah.
And the product is not just hardware. It's hardware and software. So obviously doing something right. At the same time, everybody in the place like that Brian and I are focusing on software development in the iOS and OS X, Mac OS X, we all know that iTunes kind of sucks. Like that's, I mean, wouldn't you agree, Brian?
Oh, yeah. It's not really good. All the last three or four versions have been focused on making it feel simpler and just hiding all that complexity. And yet underneath, it's still just as messy as it ever was.
So I would argue the reason why you don't like it is not because of its frequent updates, because they're not making a good product in iTunes. And that's my feeling. It's like they haven't actually cleaned it up. They actually haven't made it as great as some of the other things they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I feel, is probably the more of the frustration. And I think the reason why
it's unintuitive.
Yeah. I think
that's my problem.
One of the reasons, to summarize the problems with it is hard. But yeah, unintuitive might be one of them. I think that the thing that's going on there is they probably feel fine and justified in changing a lot because they know it's not that great. Like there's, and I don't want to speak for a whole bunch of developers. I've spent a lot of time on it. And obviously, it's a functional application. It's the most of music on the planet. It's probably the thing that's being used the most to listen to music. So that's kind of impressive right there.
But doesn't it kind of reduce the motivation to be pleasing to customers if you feel like you already have them?
So you think that trapped aspect is the reason why? Yeah.
I think that they're just not getting the, the market pressure.
Well, I would say that the reason why Apple released the Apple Music Store thing and the whole skinning is because Pandora and other services were kicking its butt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the response is this Apple Music. It actually was a long time coming. Now, that they tried to push it back into this system that updates your phone and backs up your iPod and your iPad and also lets you buy applications for a device that's not the laptop. I mean, there is so much that iTunes actually does, including the most popular podcast archiving, podcast system in the planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of crazy that they try to push in a music service on top of that.
And the hardest thing to change is something that everybody uses. So,
well, and they already have a different name for it. It's called Apple Music. Why isn't it a separate thing?
They could have made it a separate thing.
There's a lot of people think they should have.
Yeah. That's a good, I would assume that that's a good thing to do.
Yeah, there's tons of confusion over the fact that they are keeping everything into one thing because they have Apple Music, they have iTunes Match, and they have all of these files that either you are leasing or you're owning, and they're getting all
mixed
up.
That's another confusion. Yeah. Apple Match allows you to take your existing archive of music that you've ripped from CD or vinyl, whatever, try to find songs in their library that are the same file, mm-hmm. and then give you the better quality update because they ripped it theoretically to higher quality, and also sync to all your devices. So that ability to say, wow, my thousands and thousands of CDs that I've already ripped myself now can seamlessly work on all my devices, and I can even share it with my family members, and the files are better. Mm-hmm. That's great. Oh, man, fantastic. Except Apple Music is a separate service, and those do not communicate and work well together.
Okay, Fail. Fail, gentlemen.
So what
so
I want to say is,
what I want to say is why can't technological interface advancements happen at a slower pace so that everyone can catch up? It sounds like what I'm hearing from you guys is, no, actually just Apple Music and iTunes are a hot mess.
No, I think your other point is really a good one as well. And that is that you get potentially frustrated by things changing underneath you because then you have to learn more.
Yeah, it's right? on me to learn their new thing.
So the question is, when in designing something, is it better not to change it to be the feature?
Yeah. Right. And so I want to just say this about that. When we started GeekSpeak, USB was the new way of passing data. Mm-hmm. It's slower. It's not as good, right? And as we've progressed, we went to FireWire, then we're now currently at USB, what is it, 3?
3.
USB 3 with the newer connector, which is universal, which you'll see on some devices, and it's going to populate quite a bit, is a much better system. But along the way, we had 5 different ways of doing this or so with Thunderbolt and such. And all those times, you had to buy new pieces of cabling, you had to buy new adapters,
right.
You had to invest and learn, and it was frustrating.
And you're saying there's going to be another one called USB 3?
USB 3 is the next one.
And it's different from Thunderbolt?
But, okay. My point is more... It's also kind of backwards compatible with USB, so it's not going to be as painful as like Thunderbolt or FireWire.
Okay.
But my point is that, or Lightning, it's a lot of connectors.
Hey.
My point is that if we didn't progress and change the technology to improve it over time, we would still be transferring files at slow speeds, which means that you wouldn't be able to do what you can do. Like, the technology changes to improve the entire experience. We now have Retina screens.
Even if I don't experience it that way.
Well, you have a Retina screen in front of you, right? Your MacBook Pro has a Retina screen. It's a denser, beautiful image.
Okay.
And when you want to transfer data from your phone to your computer and back, it works better because Lightning is better than the other connector. These things actually improve your computer experience. The transition periods are difficult, but not the actual new tech. The new tech is the awesome part, in my opinion.
Hmm. What do you say about all that, Brian?
I really feel for those people out there that just feel like they can't keep up. But there's a crowd out there that wants new stuff, and it seems like they're going to be the ones that are going to get the new stuff. And some people are just going to have to either somehow freeze what they have or come along for the ride.
It's a little bit of the advertisement loop.
Mm-hmm.
If I make new stuff and go, hey, shiny, new, then who isn't going to turn and go like, home is a home?
Well, okay.
So who's driving what?
But let's talk about like the reason why I got the iPhone 6 versus the iPhone. I'm sorry, the iPhone 6 Plus versus the iPhone. I love taking photographs, and I invest a lot in photography.
Mm-hmm.
The iPhone 6 Plus has slightly better camera than the iPhone 6. It's the device I have on all the time. It was worth it to me to spend extra money to get better pictures.
Mm-hmm.
That camera is a better camera. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, if I were to stay back with my iPhone 4 or iPhone 3, if I could still be running that effectively at this point, the photos are just blurry and bad. I couldn't have printed them. Now I can print from my phone, right? Not from my phone, but the point is that it becomes better because what I want is physical prints that I can hang, and I want to be able to do that anytime I want. So if the technology doesn't improve, it's going to change.
The argument.
I hope it gets better.
Argument used to be you don't have to upgrade, but now in the last few years we're in a world where we've got auto updates.
Yeah, we kind of have to update. Yeah.
You do have control. Well,
and from security vulnerability perspective, you should update all the time too.
Right.
So then, okay, they've got.
So my perspective is it's on all of us to be extremely nimble. To be successful in technology, you have to change with the technology and kind of be zen about it. Like, oh, now it's changed. I used to use scrolling up and down in the opposite direction as I do now, and so change. I find that the people that have an anger towards it or frustration towards it to hold on to it carry that change longer. The sooner you can accept the change, the sooner you can embrace it, the sooner you will be using the newer tech and moving forward and enjoying yourself.
So certain kinds of minds are going to be able to just roll with it, and others that need more time to catch up. I'm a person who wishes the world would slow down in general, not just around technology.
You just invested in a typewriter, for example. You like that aesthetic, yeah.
Yeah. So is there just no room for me? Is that what the deal is?
I think there's totally room for you. But I think that being nimble with the computers is one of the things that will be more enjoyable for you if you can get to that space with regard to technology.
So here's the thing, Lyle. I totally agree with you. I'm totally on board. I live my life that way.
Okay, we win. No.
But, playing devil's advocate here,
yeah.
Does it really improve our lives?
That's a good question.
Are we improving our lives because we have to keep up with the technology, or should the technology should be molding itself to us?
I recently installed a Wi-Fi controlled water system for our garden. We no longer have to go and water by hand every one of our plants, and the plants are doing better and we're getting more vegetables because I invested in some time and energy on a technology that made it very simple for us to do that.
Okay, but that's
better?
Not my experience when interacting with my screen changes and I have to learn how to interact with my screen before I can do the thing I wanted to interact with my screen about. That sounds like it's like the Internet of Things, of everything going, yoo-hoo, you need to replace my filter, or, hey, don't forget, you know, that you need to get milk at the store, you know, the sort of being harangued by our technology.
I think this is just a great discussion that comes down to the fact that designers need to design for people, and we need to be better at that.
I wish it would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Apple, fix iTunes, would you?
Pete's sick. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP and not the Roseanne Dana segment on Saturday Night Live. We'll be right back. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and I'm speaking with Lyle Troxell and Brian Young about the big issues and also the fine details.
We were talking about being pedantic last week.
Yes.
So I just want to do a quick correction or clarification. So we were talking about USB 3. We even, I think, said USB-C, but honestly,
I never said USB-C 3, but inferred USB-C because I talked about a simpler connector.
We just said C3.
3C,
which is
CO.
It? Okay, so this is a new type of connector that's coming, which is apparently not going to be as maddening as the switch to something completely new like Thunderbolt.
Okay, just a quick public service announcement. We've had USB 1, we've had USB 2, we've had USB 3.
Those are all the same connectors.
They're all
almost.
The same connectors.
They all look the same.
They all look the same for the most. Well, they look the same,
yeah.
But sometimes there is a 1-for-3 that's special. Now, for some phones and some computers that are just coming out, they have USB-C, which is the USB 3 speed. But it's a different connector. And this is going to be the one connector to rule them all.
And the reason for this is this connector you can plug in upside down or right side up. Or there is no upside down.
Oh, really?
Yes. Like the Lightning
Suddenly
connector.
Suddenly, Bonnie, interested.
Yes.
How is the home?
Because technology improves.
Okay. All right.
And you'll have the same connector on both ends eventually.
Maybe.
Eventually.
Yeah.
When all your devices are old, broken, you throw them out and you get new ones.
Yeah. Apple's newest laptop, the MacBook, which is a low-end kind of highly expensive Macintosh computer, has one connector only on it. It is a USB-C connector. It provides power, and also you can use it to power a second laptop, or a second monitor, and also you can plug in a keyboard. It's a USB connector, but
okay.
Also
it does all the things. Huh. Fascinating.
Mm.
I guess we'll look for that when it becomes available.
Thank you for that clarity, Brian. Good.
So I also wanted to let people know that we would love to have you communicate with us. One way you can reach GeekSpeak is via Twitter or Facebook. We're at KUSP Geeks. That's all one word. And if you have questions or comments for us, you can send a tweet. We'll collect them up and respond next week. Or you could just email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP, and we're down to the energy department. I want to talk about energy and food, which you could argue is also energy. But let's start with more traditionally thought of energy. And since we were just talking about frustrating iPhone things in that last segment, let's talk about energy for phones.
So this story, we've talked about hydrogen fuel cells before on the show.
Yes.
And so this is a way to take hydrogen, you mix it with mix it with oxygen, and you get water.
Yes, that's true.
And energy.
H2O.
Water and energy. Mm-hmm. Water, energy, and heat.
Yes.
So the people have been trying to figure out how to use hydrogen for a long time. We talked about it in cars. Now we've talked about it in electronic devices, but nothing has ever come out that actually uses hydrogen in something like a phone or a laptop that I know of.
The energy consumption levels are such that you could theoretically, put a cartridge in and get the same kind of performance as a battery, and there'd be no acid involved, right? It's a catalyst.
Well, we just spray some hydrogen in there. What do you mean?
You'd actually kind of It'd be like a canister. This is the confusion part. This is the part that's hard.
Yeah, yeah. So the simplest way is to compress hydrogen gas into almost a liquid form or mm-hmm. liquid form and get it into something and then use the catalyst.
Use a catalyst to convert it and then pull electricity from that.
And then there's lots of people have tried to figure out other ways to pelletize it in some form mm-hmm. where you add water in another way and it mixes up and you still get hydrogen and you still have the fuel cell reaction. So a company in Britain has been talking openly about their project where they, using an iPhone as their prototype, have mm-hmm. shoehorned their own hydrogen cell, fuel cell, into an iPhone, and as well as keeping some amount of battery, although they're not clear on how much of that is battery.
It'll be a hybrid.
And yes, it is exactly a hybrid. And really, all the hydrogen fuel cell is doing is generating electricity for you. So you're both charging that little battery and using the phone at the same time. Mm-hmm. They are getting a week's worth of charge Whoa. Out of one fuel cell along with this little battery as well.
I have to plug this thing in every day.
Yeah, yeah. I know. No. Well, and they're, you know, they're not giving us exact numbers. I don't know whether I would get a week's
worth. Is this fuel cell smaller than a toaster?
The fuel cell?
Yeah, yeah. Really? Is it convenient?
They are doing this without modifying the basic shape of the phone.
No way! That's amazing. That's amazing.
The modifications they made are changing the headphone port so that you can fill up the hydrogen cell
cool.
through the headphone port. And they have to have a place for the moisture that is generated to
come
out.
Right. What about the water?
They have little vents on the back that
let it drips.
Out. So cool. They're talking about this publicly, and they're talking about their partner company is hoping to come out with this in the next couple of years. But mm-hmm. they're being really cagey. Yeah. Lots of people are pointing to the fact that, well, this is their prototype device as an mm-hmm. iPhone. They think that they've been talking to Apple before. So the hope from the Apple geeks is that this is going to come to an iPhone in the future.
If they're being public and they're using Apple as an example,
this is my
Apple's
point.
Not working with them.
That's my exact point. That just does not happen. Apple loves to cut off partners that want to be too public.
Catalysts can be very expensive. Different, you know, chemical reactions can be expensive. It's possible that the system would cost too much.
Well, and would they let it on the plane? I mean, aren't people worried about it exploding or something?
Nah,
they don't talk about how expensive the system is, but they do say the price of enough hydrogen to run your phone for a week would be about the price of a latte. So that's going to be more expensive than electricity.
Mm-hmm. Not much. But for a week?
What? A week's worth of electricity for your iPhone? That can't even register 10 or 20 cents.
Yeah, but a cup of coffee for a week is not something you have to worry about either, really.
Yes, if you're spending $100-some on your phone every month.
Two sips a day.
Right. And tasty.
Certainly it'll allow you to go out camping with your iPhone for a week.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not what you need to do when you're camping. I don't know.
I do.
Well, speaking of the outdoors, another fine form of energy is solar energy. And Google came up with an interesting project that's being floated.
Yeah. You've used Google Maps, right?
Yes.
And you've seen the satellite imagery of Google Maps?
I've found Mama's house on
Yes.
it.
And Google Earth, of course, is great, too, because you can mm-hmm. kind of fly around. Mm-hmm. Google has a world map, basically, of the planet, which is convenient. They actually do the moon and Mars, too, which are kind of neat. But our planet has a quality in that cities are full of buildings with a lot of roof area.
Yes.
And this has, of course, led to the kind of solar revolution where people take and put solar cells on their roof of their house, plug into the grid and backfeed when peak hours and basically neutralize their bill for a period of time. Now, that whole process is sometimes subsidized and there's companies doing it. You can get leased. There's a whole bunch of processes on how to do this. But where do you start? One way you want to start, kind of, is to find out if your house is a good house to get solar energy.
Mm-hmm.
So Google's Google Project Sunroof is what it's called. It's one of these projects that started by an engineer having 20% time. Mm-hmm. By the way, Google employee engineers used to have this idea of 20% time. Basically, one day a week you could work on your own project mm-hmm. as long as it was kind of associated with something that Google could use later on. A lot of the projects we've seen from Google came from this. I thought it had been stopped, but I have it on good authority that actually some departments allow this still to occur.
Ooh.
Right. It's not universal, but,
but the
culture is still there in some parts of the company.
So Google Project Sunroof currently is working in San Francisco Bay Area. I checked in Santa Cruz, it doesn't. But Fresno, which of course is Central California, and also in Boston, where you can go find your house on the map, register some information about your electrical bill, how much you spend on electricity,
what?
And they will do the calculations based on how much sun your house gets per year. if what kind of if a solar package would make sense for your environment.
Wait a minute. So it's not just going, that seems like a good roof for a solar panel, that seems like a good roof for a solar panel. It's actually doing the math so you know what
they're,
you'd be in for
yeah,
if you were to take the plunge.
They're doing all the maths, and they're even hooking you up with suggested retailers that can provide services for
oh,
you.
Of course
so
they
you
are.
Really, it's, I don't know if they're even figuring out if they're going to get a cut of this. It's much more about, you know, is it feasible, and to get you thinking about it. So if you're in one of those areas,
yeah,
take a look at it. It's free to use right now, Google Project Sunroof, and it's a cool idea to get it really dead simple to figure out, does it make sense to move forward
right,
with solar energy in my
I
house?
I wonder how much solar companies charge for that kind of a consultation.
Oh,
you know,
oh,
or
I
if have, they have, I, if it's a burdensome inclusion to try and get business.
I have solar companies calling me all the time that want to come out and give me a price quote on exactly what it would be. So
yeah, no,
okay,
it's a free quote normally, but you know, it's a hassle.
It's a hassle.
But also,
in a way, they're kind of saving the solar companies a bit of
I think
of
that,
a hassle. Although, that, if you think about it from kind of like a job security. You know, mm-hmm, if we're trying to get solar jobs, is going to be the hope for instance, inner city youth, then are we taking jobs away from people
well,
who could really use them?
I got to say that the installation process and what company you actually go for is a really important decision, because some situations you're going to lease the solar panels, and after the end of that lease period, you have to then potentially buy them, mm-hmm, or they make them back. I mean, the idea is that some solar companies are becoming their own power company and just using your house and your money to do that.
Mm.
So it is really important to figure out exactly what kind of system you want to install. Mm-hmm. And so more research is better. And as soon as you have a conversation with a company, they're going to be whining and dining you
yeah,
on
then
doing
it's all
it with
about
them.
That company's way
right,
rather than what would be
and
most beneficial for you.
This is a little more neutral in the sense right, that it's like, well, your location can handle this kind of system.
It's a little more neutral, though. We got to treat this as a 1.0 project. In fact,
absolutely,
that
yeah,
probably is why they're rolling it out in just a couple areas.
Select cities.
I have at least one Twitter person that I follow that did his own test, and he already has solar panels on his roof, and he says it was just way off for him.
Oh, really? He tried it out? Yeah.
Yeah. What I'm wondering is, I'm not sure whether he's in the fog belt of the Bay Area, whether he's has a
well, they should be calculating for that,
they
right?
Should
Google, so
yeah,
they should understand weather conditions as well.
Oh, so I hope that information gets back to Google.
Well,
that
you know, Google's pretty good at data. So.
Yeah, they're good at collecting data.
Yes, they are. That's their kind of their deal. All right, so that's item two in the energy department. Now let's switch over for the food department.
Well, this is actually another Google project, a Google experiment, and it was called Foodographs.
Okay.
The word food in front of photographs.
Oh, food.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, got it.
And it was a 20%, I think, project where you could go and have an app called Foodographs that would take pictures of food at restaurants, because people seem to like to do that, and then to collect that data and share it and connect it to the store.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of associated with Google Plus. Well,
okay,
recently, some early adopter people who have been selected are getting announcements on their Android phone. After they've taken a picture of food,
mm-hmm,
Google detects with their algorithms that they took a picture of food. It looks like it's good lighting or interesting, whatever.
Yeah,
and
machine learning's working out.
They prompt you with a, hey, this looks like a picture of food. Want to share it with other people? And prompt you to basically pick the restaurant that it was at, basically allowing you to then kind of help you write a review of the place you went to eat. This is, of course, in direct competition with Yelp, which is a partner, a
right,
company that continually Google and Yelp have debates with each other. Sometimes Google likes to surface Yelp's results on their engine and
oh,
taking away basically
mine,
the service from Yelp. And so there's some fights in court and such.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of photographs of food actually going where they're supposed to go. Not your Facebook feed, not your Twitter feed, but associated to the restaurant that you might later want to look at. Because if I'm in some city and mm-hmm, I look up a restaurant mm-hmm, and I find out, hey, Brian has a photograph of that restaurant, that's a picture of Brian's food I actually want to see, because I'm about to go there to eat. So
oh, I see,
to me, it seems like a cool
idea.
But
it seems like a nice way to help out restaurants also, you know, compile pictures of the food that they offer, assuming you've taken a good picture of their food.
Right.
I mean, I hear some people are actually objecting, some chefs are objecting to having their food photographed.
Well, in you know, food photography is an art, so it's not easy to do.
Yeah.
So doing it under the light of a restaurant isn't going to necessarily be the ideal situation.
Well, yeah, I've seen a lot of grainy photos of food from restaurants that people have taken.
Now,
yeah,
now if only we can make sure we get all of the menus photographed so I can be sure that menu still exists before I get to the restaurant.
Right.
That would be great.
So
there's a German court decision in 2013 that widened copyright law in Germany to apply to applied arts. Applied arts, for example, is Gastronomy. And so in Germany, it looks like a chef at a restaurant who is an artist in Germany, and the food they produce is an art form and they're copyrightable under art form law, mm-hmm. can stop people from taking pictures of their food and because it would be a derivative work.
Oh, interesting. So when we think of, like if I go to a restaurant and the food comes to the table, I don't see the chef. I see a thing that I am buying, and I figure it is mine to photograph. But in Germany, what I'm photographing is an artist's work, and I should give credit where credit's due?
I guess.
Okay. And so does that get into...
Well, I think it's interesting to see this kind of debate in every area of copyright. And so the German story, which of course you can read completely at techdirt.com, but we'll have it up at geekspeak.org, about chefs basically taking takedown notices of photographs of people's...
Is that what's going on
that's
now?
That's what's going on.
So when German chefs are considered artists, then it's time for them to...
Protect their art form.
Protect their art form. And it's time for us to wrap up GeekSpeak today. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. And to find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at GeekSpeak.org or email us at geeks@geekspeak.org or contact us on Twitter. We're at KUSP Geeks. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Brian Young. Thank you for joining us for this August 29th episode of GeekSpeak.